tuned into Spirit Mornings with Bruce McGregor and
Chris McGregor.
Bringing on board again Mike Aquilina, author of Mass of the Early Christians and three other books on the early church, all published through our Sunday Visitor. Also, Chris always reminds me to remember the Grail Code book as well.
It's so good.
Yes, it is. Mike, Vice President of the St. Paul Center for Biblical Theology, we encourage you to visit their website, www.salvationhistory.com. Mike, good morning. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, Bruce. Good morning, Chris. It's great to be back.
Good morning, Mike. I think I'm going to call you Mike of Chrysostom.
I don't think so.
I think the masses will speak and say that I'm correct, because Chrysostom is not his last name. It's a special title, actually, or nickname.
It is. It is. It means golden mouth.
See? It works.
I don't think so. Listen to me tripping over myself now.
No.
You hexed me.
It's the words that flow out of that. That's what I'm talking about, because you're once again here to help break open the lives of the fathers. And St. John Chrysostom, who was one who had a very important role in the life of the church.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, it's funny. He really did get that nickname because he was the most renowned preacher of the early church. You know, we can say he was like renowned the way Billy Graham was in the 20th century.
Oh, good analogy.
Okay.
Yeah, and he what's amazing is you know how hard it is to keep track of things over the years, and you can imagine what it's like over millennia. Things get lost very easily. So there are many writers in the early church whose works have entirely been lost. But in the case of Chrysostom, we have more than 700 of his authentic homilies from a relatively short life.
Wow.
He was such a renowned preacher that people wanted to take down his every word, and they wanted to hold on to them, copy them, and really take hold of them. Of course, he was so effective that it ended up getting him in no end of trouble during his lifetime, but it got him to heaven, and that's what we're all supposed to be after.
Absolutely. Well, he lived during a very tumultuous time. I mean, he was born in the year 347, and so that was a time where there was a lot of flux going on in the church and in the world.
Sure. I mean, it was still growing pains. We were still getting used to this idea of having a Christian empire, and Chrysostom was a son of a high government official in Syrian province. He was born in Antioch. So he was born into a family of some prestige. His father died when he was a baby.
Oh, okay.
His mother was left a widow at age 20, and they say she was very beautiful, strikingly beautiful woman, and she must have had some means because of her husband's position. But she made the decision never to marry again because of St. Paul's advice that it's better not to.
Mm-hmm.
She made the decision then that she would just live a Christian life geared toward heaven, and she would raise her son this way. And she raised him with such a love for Jesus Christ and such a desire for heaven that when he was a teenager, he wanted to leave and go off and live as a hermit.
Mm.
She vehemently opposed that because it would be like, you know, being left a widow all over again, she said.
Right.
Be left alone, this poor woman. And you got to figure, by this time, she's just in her mid-30s.
Sure.
So she thought of going through that again, and it was just too much. So he did leave and left to live in a monastic community, which was easier on her. She still got to see him and everything. But after a while, he decided that wasn't quite enough, and he did leave to live the life of a hermit. While he was living the life of a hermit, he committed much of the Holy Scriptures to memory.
Wow.
Just memorized it, labored at this night and day, prayed the Scriptures night and day, until he had great portions committed to memory, and he fasted severely, and in the process he wrecked his health.
Right.
Mm.
And so he had to return to civilization, as it were, and go the more conventional route of a life of service to the church. He was ordained first a deacon for the See of Antioch, and the bishop really put him in charge of everything. He was the vicar general in his diocese. So, anyway, the one thing I skipped was that his mother did provide him a great education, not only in religion. You see that he picked up a great deal of piety from her. But she also secured for him education with the most renowned orator in the world at that time, Libanius, who was teaching in Antioch. And people would come from the four corners of the earth to study under Libanius. he was a pagan. Mm-hmm. We still have many of his speeches, we still have many of his letters today, because he was so famous, and he had many famous students who were among the pagans and the Christians. But Chrysostom studied under Libanius, who was a great orator, and Chrysostom may have been this man's greatest and most accomplished student of all of them.
You know, Mike, it occurs to me that to have an appreciation of what it is to be an orator or one who was really, really gifted in rhetoric, we'd have to understand, again, take us out of ourselves and know that there was no television. Not everybody had books or the ability to be able to read. So in an evening or a gathering, they would gather to listen to people expound ideas.
That's right. And that was entertainment in that time.
Exactly. So someone who was very gifted in this would have been quite the star.
Oh, sure. And we know that he was. There was something of a crisis in Antioch during his early years, because there was a protest. Mm-hmm. The emperor had levied some taxes against the people of Antioch, and the people didn't like it, and so they had a protest, and the protest kind of got out of hand. And what they did was they pulled down the statues of the imperial family.
Ooh.
and just crushed them to dust. And this was an act of rebellion at that point.
Right.
The emperor, you know, by law, had the right to just exterminate the citizens if he wanted to.
Oh, dear.
And so there was a lot of anxiety in the city. People were living in fear for their lives. And St. John's big debut, as it were, these weren't his first homilies, but these were the first that put him on the map.
Mm-hmm.
The bishop went off to Constantinople to plead with the emperor to pardon the people of Antioch, because they really were fearing for their lives, and some of them were fleeing for their lives.
Mm-hmm.
But St. John stayed behind, and he preached to the people every day while the bishop was away. And the final homily is the one on the bishop's return with the good news that they weren't going to be crushed like bugs. But John's homilies are interesting, and they're really kind of representative of his style, because, one, he made it very clear to the people, this is your fault. Your actions have consequences.
Mm-hmm.
And these are the consequences of riot and insurrection and a rebellious spirit. This is what happens to you when you violate God's order. He made it very clear to them. But at the same time, he was able to provide consolation, keeping their view on eternity and helping them to identify with Jesus Christ and their sufferings, especially in that time. So we see that throughout St. John. He never minced words. He never held back, but he was always able to provide Christian consolation to his listeners.
Right. And, of course, that inability to kind of hold back would get him in considerable difficulty when he was called from Antioch up to Constantinople.
Oh, sure. And you can imagine from his personality, just what we know of him so far, that he's not the kind of guy who had a career plan, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He didn't want to be on the escalator going up in terms of worldly success. And the emperor knew this, but his reputation was really going all over the world for preaching. So the emperor, when the See of Constantinople came open, he wanted a prestige preacher in that pulpit.
Mm-hmm.
So he went for the best in the world, and it would be John Chrysostom. Well, the governor out there in Syria said, there ain't no way you're getting that guy to leave Antioch.
Yeah.
Right.
He's too humble. And so what they did was they brought the state coach to his door, and they called him outside, and they kind of trapped him in this coach.
Uh-oh.
And they transported him to Constantinople that way. But they were only able to do it by kind of tricking him to get into the coach, and then just make him stay put until he got to Constantinople. So he did end up in the imperial city.
Mm-hmm.
And in the imperial city, of course, he had the most visible, the most audible pulpit in the empire. And he was able to affect so much. That really was the primary see in the East.
Mm-hmm.
And in a sense, it was the most influential in the world, because Constantinople was the second Rome. It was the seat of the empire.
Right.
Mike, would you say that Constantinople would be, if you were to try to do an equivalent today, would be like New York City?
New York City and Washington, D.C. put together.
Okay.
Okay.
That's the way I'd look at it. Because you have the seat of governmental power as well.
Right.
Not only commercial, but governmental and cultural. It's all all gathered together in one place around the throne of the emperor. And the emperor had had an archbishop, a patriarch there in Constantinople, who was very political, very mm-hmm. diplomatic, was able to maintain peace among a lot of different factions, like rebellious priests. They mm-hmm. had a big problem with discipline among the priests. A lot of the priests were living scandalous lives. He was able to keep peace with the monasteries. The monasteries were very revered by the people, but sometimes they almost set themselves up as an alternative magisterium within the church. This previous bishop had kind of let them go their way. And then there was the imperial throne, and you had to keep the empress happy, because the empress was the one who was keeping an eye on you, and you had to make sure you stayed on her good side.
She had some time on her hands.
Yes, yeah. Time on her hands, and often in the case of these arranged marriages and everything, you're dealing with people with an enormous amount of vanity, who were very much tuned into popularity. The empress, a lot of her position in the empire depended on her popularity among her subjects, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, St. John came into this church, and he was always kind of a radical, always calling people to a radical dedication to the gospel, and everything was always grounded in the scriptures. Well, the first thing he did was reform the clergy.
Yeah. Well,
and you can imagine how well that went over with the priests. And
yeah.
The other thing he did was to make sure that the monasteries knew that they were part of the church. You know, they weren't an alternative church. They weren't an alternative magisterium. So already you see he's making some enemies. And then he started preaching against things like spending a lot of money on clothing.
Uh-oh.
Started talking about people who toilets in their bathrooms made of gold. And he started talking about the use of makeup and that sort of thing. And as the empress was hearing these things or reading the reports of them, she kept seeing herself in these sermons, rightly or wrongly.
Mm-hmm.
She perceived that they were aimed at her, because in the palace they did have golden chamber pots.
How special.
Right. And he said it's sinful for some people to have golden chamber pots while in the same city others are going hungry.
Mm-hmm.
And he tried to point this out to people. Well, anyway, she was not pleased, and she made it clear to her husband, and he called this wicked council of just a small number of bishops, all of whom were declared enemies of John. And so it was really a trumped-up thing. And they summoned John, and he said, no, I'm not going to that council. I'm not going to this charade. And he refused to go, and so in absentia, they convicted him. They sentenced him to exile. On the day he was supposed to leave, something happened in the palace. We don't know what it is, but it must have been something catastrophic. And the emperor took it as a sign that God did not approve of what was going on here.
Yeah.
And so the emperor retracted the sentence, but eventually there was just too much of a clamor for John's removal. And so eventually he was exiled to a rough part of the world in what's now Armenia. And he went out there and he kept up his correspondence. As a matter of fact, all the letters we have from John come from this period of his life. And he kept up his correspondence, and people actually made pilgrimage to see him. They came from all over the world to visit him and get spiritual direction from him. And this infuriated the empress, that his fame went with him, that he wasn't really being punished, because she was thinking, you know, she was a vain woman.
Sure.
And she was thinking that John must be like her, and this would just feed his vanity. Well, John was thinking that this is an injustice. He didn't enjoy being archbishop, but he thought God wanted him to be archbishop, and he should be there.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, there he was, and the imperial family wasn't happy about his situation, so they decided that he should have an even more harsh atmosphere for his exile. So they sent him to this place that was even more remote, and where the weather was horrible and his conditions would be bad. They forced him to march there. Now, his health hadn't been anything to speak of since he was a young man, and he destroyed it as a hermit.
Right.
But they made him march, and along the way, the conditions were so bad that he died.
Now, he was about 60 years old at that point, wasn't he, Mike?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So he didn't have a long period of active preaching, but he left behind a lot of sermons for that, and so many of those have survived. We have surviving commentary on almost every book in the Bible from St. John Chrysostom. Mm. You could do a Bible commentary just from his works on the whole Bible.
Yeah.
Boy, that would be a thing for study. I bet you've read them too, haven't you?
Well, I haven't read all 700, but I do enjoy reading St. John. One thing I like about reading him is that he's so practical.
Mm-hmm.
When he's preaching about very down-to-earth, nitty-gritty, everyday life situations in the home. He's talking about marriage. He's talking about child-rearing. He's talking about the problems that you encounter when you send your kids to school. These are very practical things, and I think that's what's kept these things in print for, you know, more than a millennium and a half.
Yeah.
You know, Mike, how I came to really know St. John Chrysostom was through the exercises that I did when I was entering into Living the Mysteries, a guide for unfinished Christians that you co-authored with Scott Hahn.
Right.
Which is, you know, I don't think we mentioned this enough. This is one of the most, it is a wonderful tool to enter into a 7-week study of the fathers and to really reflect and to pray with them. And you chose for one of the, towards the end of the concluding weeks, to study the way of life under St. John Chrysostom.
Well, that's right. It's so hard to know where to begin with him because there's mm-hmm. so much material. But it's also sacramental. And in Living the Mysteries, we were trying to look at the 7 sacraments of the Church and look behind the veil to see what's going on in the order of grace.
Right.
We all know what we see in the sacraments and what we taste mm-hmm. and what we hear, but what's going on behind the veil? And that's what St. John was so good at explaining. And so we use some of his material, especially his material on the priesthood, because really there is no one greater in antiquity for describing the mystery of the Christian priesthood. One of his early tracts was on the priesthood, and he wrote it for a friend of his. It was a series of dialogues.
Mm-hmm. Well, and he wrote about celibacy at a time when it was not a chosen discipline throughout the universal priesthood of the Church.
Well, that's true. He was writing about celibacy at a time in the Eastern Church when it was just beginning to become widespread to have married priests
mm-hmm.
at the parish level. The monasteries still had celibate members,
mm-hmm.
and some of those would be ordained for the service of the monastery. And at that time, the bishops were taken almost exclusively from the ranks of the celibate clergy,
mm-hmm.
From the monasteries. If a married priest were selected as bishop, then at that point he would begin to live celibacy as a bishop, because you were supposed to be married to the Church.
Right.
Right, and he writes so beautifully about that.
Oh, he does. He does, because he could see in his own life and in the life of his mother,
mm-hmm.
you know, that this could be something that turned you more completely toward God. It was a gift of something good. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, there's no hatred of marriage in St. John.
Oh, no.
Often people bring up this one letter he wrote to one of his companions who was struggling with celibacy and considering leaving the monastic life. And he really did kind of use strong words with him, because this was his vocation. He had a celibate vocation, and he was going to abandon it.
Mm-hmm.
So St. John used strong words with him, and people will often bring that out and say, oh, he was anti-marriage. But that is not true, because if you go through especially his homilies on Ephesians, where he's going over St. Paul's teaching on marriage, and he's bringing it out in sermon after sermon after sermon with such loving detail, describing the love of a man for a woman for a man, and parents for their children, and children for their parents. This is a man who experienced a rich and affectionate family life and who knew its value as a sign of God's love in the world.
Mm.
Yeah, for sure.
And he benefited from it so much, too. John was the great man he was because he had such a good and loving mother, and I'm sure because he had a father who even though he had no memory of his father, I'm sure his father provided well for the family so that they could continue after his death.
Mm-hmm.
It really strikes me that as he's writing, because he had such a great love for Scripture and he knew it so well, that his teachings on the relationship between a man and a woman, we look at theology of the body today, and there are roots that go into St. John Chrysostom.
Absolutely, and we tried to bring that out in Living the Mysteries. We tried to make those connections. He brings up those deep Trinitarian roots of Christian marriage. Mm-hmm. He tries to show that the bond is that strong. It's a bond of communion, just like the bond that unites the persons of the Trinity.
Right. Well, Mike, before we finish up on St. John here, we want to probably put the postscript on here because, of course, at the time of his death in 407, shortly thereafter, the Pope and the Western Church broke off communication with this area until they repented, which, in fact, they did. Can you tell that story?
Well, they did. It was such a travesty of justice what happened to John. And really, someone had to say that the imperial authority did not extend over the church.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Had to make that very clear, as Ambrose did in the West. Well, what happened was that the Pope, as you say, excommunicated the people who were involved in this and the sees. They said, you are no longer in communion with Rome. There was eventually a reconciliation, and John's relics were brought back to Constantinople, mm-hmm. where they remained for many centuries afterwards. But they were welcomed back to Constantinople by the Empress's son. So it was a true reconciliation in that it was the imperial family and the direct descendant of the woman who had caused all this trouble, right, was welcoming John back into the city.
Excellent. And not long after, he would be named a father of doctor of the church, that is.
Oh, yeah.
And actually then Pius X, I think it was, named him the patron saint of preachers.
That's a good thing. As I mentioned before, he was such a prolific preacher, but also such an effective one, and one who took a lot of care with his professional development. He knew it wasn't just going to come from the Holy Spirit, that he had to correspond to it by developing his human capacity to deliver the word. He did that by studying under the very best teacher he could, even though that teacher was not a Christian.
Right.
Well, we've been studying under you, and I think we've been very blessed.
Well, I've been having a good time. It's always so much fun to talk about these people.
Oh, absolutely. Mike of Chrysostom.
She's not going to let that go, Mike.
Well, I just think you're such a blessing in the work that you do. And
Mike, thanks so much for being with us. We really appreciate this talk on St. John Chrysostom this morning.
Thanks for having me.